The American History Podcast, Season 1, Episode 7, Southern Culture.
Welcome to the American History Podcast. Hosted by Sean Worswick.
Okay, just a quick note. It is currently the summer of 2020, and I'm re-recording all of Season 1 as a celebration of the fact that we've made it to our third anniversary. These episodes were originally recorded before I knew what I was doing, or actually before I had a sound editor, and I'm not now going back and bringing the sound quality up to our normal standards. I hope you enjoy the show. Also, I should mention that I've not changed the script from its original format. Okay, so from this point forward, the show will be exactly as it was in the original recording. Welcome back. We are back to our regular schedule, or so I hope. I also hope you are all as excited by this as I am. I really enjoyed doing this show and bringing you some information about American history that perhaps you did not learn in school. Busting the myths of American history is what we do here, and I truly thank you all for listening. Before we get started, please go to the website, www.theamericanhistorypodcast.com, and vote in the poll. I'm trying to figure out what topic we'll cover in Season 2. Your choices are 1, the American War for Independence, number 2, the Cold War, number 3, the Vietnam War, and number 4, the War with Mexico. I'll close the poll on December 20th, 2017, so please be sure to go and vote. There are literally thousands of you listening to this podcast, which I find truly hard to believe, and it will only take a minute to vote. So please be kind and help me out. Thanks. Also, while you're on the site, please sign up for email updates. I promise I don't send a bunch of emails out. Actually, I only email when I publish a new episode, so you need not worry about me emailing you 100 times a day. Southern culture is the topic of today's episode, and I think it's one that you will find informative and fascinating. First, the South is America, plain and simple. To understand America, you really need to understand the South. What groups of people made up the South? Southerners are truly a mixture of the Cavaliers, who were mentioned in Episode 5, along with the Celtic and African cultures. If you remember, the Cavaliers dominated Southern political and social life. But when one moves to the frontier areas, you find the Celts had a great amount of influence there. Cavalier culture dominated the low areas along the coast, while the Celtic culture dominated in the backwoods regions. So, who were the Celts? These people came from North Britain, Ireland, and Scotland. They did not come over all at once, but came in waves, and they came in fairly large numbers. They will continue to come over up through the 18th century. The first wave, if you want to call it that, took place, as historian David Hackett Fisher notes in his famous book Albion Seed, in the summer-fall of 1717. He also notes that this movement was very large, more than 250,000 people altogether. It was also different in that it drew from a different part of Britain, the aforementioned territories which bordered the Irish Sea. Why did they come? Well, for the most part, they came over with the hopes of bettering themselves materially. They had it tough in the British Isles, and they hoped that they could come over and make a new life for themselves. Now, having said that, they were from a mixture of different social classes. Not all of them were from the bottom rung of society, as one might suspect. They weren't all Catholic either, but were a mixture of different Christian denominations, be they Protestant or Catholic. If you had to pick, you'd say they were Presbyterian. And finally, these people tended to settle in the backcountry of America, in other words, the mountains. And it was the backcountry which ended up producing some of the more famous Americans in our history, people such as Andrew Jackson, James K. Polk, John C. Calhoun, Patrick Henry, and Sam Houston all came from this group and from the backcountry. Now, I should mention that these folks entered mostly through the port of Philadelphia. They then moved into the surrounding countryside, squatting on any vacant land they could find. The Quakers, who already were living in the region, were not too happy about this invasion of newcomers. One resident at the time referred to them as audacious and disorderly. Another wrote, quote, "I must own from my own experience in the land office that the settlement of 5 families from Ireland gives me more trouble than 50 of any other people," end quote. It should also be noted that these newcomers brought with them the ancient border habit of belligerence towards other ethnic groups. Now, we've touched on the social makeup to a lesser extent, but let's look deeper at it for a moment. this group of people was not simply made up of one social class or the other. There were those who believed, as did one Anglican priest, that these immigrants were, quote, the scum of two nations, end quote. Others believed they were of the middle class. Both were actually right. It was truly a mixed group. A small but certainly important minority were from the Irish and Northern British gentry. But they were no more than 2% of the total. The majority were from the ranks below that of the gentry and statesmen. Many of these people were farmers and farm workers who owned no land of their own and simply wanted to better themselves. Finally, few of them came in bondage. Indentured servants were a distinct minority of these people. Now, keeping this in mind, let us discuss what Fisher refers to as the speechways, the way people talk. Here in the United States, you can hear distinctive family of regional dialects. For example, there's a difference between the dialects of Ozark and the Appalachian Mountains, compared to the lower Mississippi Valley. Differences, again, between, say, Texas and the Southern Plains. Fisher notes that the American way of speech is at least 200 years old and recognized as early as the years before the War of Independence. At this point, it was referred to as Scotch-Irish speech, and it came to dominate that area as other ethnic groups adopted it as their own. Now, some examples of this Scotch-Irish speech, which is similar to the language spoken today in the Southern Highlands, has become familiar as the English of, say, country western singers, truck drivers, film cowboys, and backcountry politicians. So what do I mean by that? Well, they say war for where, thar for there, hard for hired, critter for creature, sartin for certain, a goin' for goin', hit for it, hit for hit, far for fire, deaf for deaf, pizen for poison, naked for naked, each for itch, boosh for bush, wrassle for wrestling, or wrestle, and chaw for chew. In grammar, it also differs in many ways from other English dialects. One example is in the verb construction, such as he come in, she done finished, they growed up, the plural they is judged, the interrogative you wasn't there, was you, the emphatic he done did it, and the use of hoove as a past participle of heave. They also have some distinctive words, such as fornenst, next to, skift for dusting of snow, fixin for getting ready to do something, nigh for near, lettin' on means pretending, and honey as a term of endearment. Secondly, the ways of marriage or marriage ways. Now, there were voluntary and involuntary abductions. This was, believe it or not, a very old custom in the English, Irish, and Scottish border countries or counties, one that had been elaborately regulated through the centuries by folk laws requiring payment of a body price and honor price. There were two types of abduction. The voluntary, which is where the bride went willingly but without her family's prior consent. Involuntary, of course, was without the bride's consent. This custom would make its way into the American backcountry, and even future president Andrew Jackson took his wife through an act of voluntary abduction. Now, of course, the problem was that Rachel was unhappily married to another man at that time. A series of quarrels ensued until Rachel Robards made her own preferences clear, and Jackson threatened her husband that he would cut his ears out of his head, at which point Jackson was arrested. While the case was awaiting trial, Jackson took it upon himself to chase down Robards, butcher knife in hand, at which point Robards fled the area. Thus, the trial never took place. After all, you do need a plaintiff. And, with the case dismissed, Jackson married Rachel. Weddings could often include shooting, drinking, kissing, and dancing. In other words, they'd have been one wild party, and they lasted for days. A custom we might recognize was the wedding toast. After dinner, each of the male guests raised a bottle in his right hand and exclaimed, "Here's to the bride, thumping luck and big children." Now, I'm not sure what part about thumping luck is all about, but it was pretty obvious that big children, especially boys, was what most families needed. This was, after all, a highly warlike society, one in perpetual warfare with Native Americans, and there was no end in sight to the violence. This gives us insight not only into their wedding customs, but into the gender relationships in the backcountry. Men were warriors, women were workers. These ideas also came from Britain. Now, child rearing was all about building up the child's will. Boys, it was thought, should have fierce pride, stubborn independence, and the courage of a warrior. All children in the South, in general, would have had immense freedom. Girls were expected to be industrious, obedient, patient, and devoted to others. Andrew Jackson is again another good example for us to observe. He would remember his youth as one in which he was, quote, wild, frolicsome, mischievous, daring, and reckless, end quote. His upbringing made him someone who was quick to take offense and with a temper that was explosive. He was a young militiaman, or I should say when he was a young militiaman, he was described as fearless and bold. Everything one would want in a young man born into a militant culture. Now, once a young boy put on his first pair of pants, he followed his parents around and was allowed a great deal of freedom on the farm. Further, at an early age, males were given their own miniature weapons, an axe, a knife, a bow, even a toy gun. While corporal punishment was condemned in the abstract, there are numerous autobiographies of backcountry folk who remembered terrific beatings being dished out by frustrated parents who were unable to control their children or incapable of controlling their own rage. Now, religious ways in the South included an intense hostility to organized churches and the clergy, but there was a genuine interest in religion. In the backcountry, most were Presbyterian, and oftentimes you had churches that met in tents. Fisher refers to them as militant Christians. While most were Presbyterian, there were Anglicans and a smattering of Catholics amongst the immigrants. The two Protestant denominations, Anglican and Presbyterian, would have shown a strong tendency towards what is referred to as New Light Christianity. We will discuss the New Lights when we get into the New Englanders, but for now, suffice it to say, they believed in free grace and held prayer meetings and created prayer societies, a custom which they carried with them into the backcountry of the North American continent. When it comes to names, these folks did not, in general, adopt high-toned, royalist names. In Appalachia, a lot of the place names came from the geography of Britain. For example, the most common name in the region was Cumberland, a British country in the extreme northwestern portion of England. There was Cumberland, Maryland, a Cumberland River in Tennessee, and the Cumberland Mountains in Kentucky and Cumberland Knob in North Carolina. Speaking of North Carolina, one finds there a Galloway Creek, Galloway Crossroads, Galloway Mountain, and a Galloway Town. So you find numerous instances of Durham being used as well. And one of the interesting naming conventions is how many of the backcountry places reflected other aspects of the border culture, especially their foodways. Examples include place names such as Clabber Branch Frying Pan, Corn Cake, Whiskey Springs, and Hangover Creek. I don't think I'd like to live in Hangover Creek myself. Place names not only reflected their food culture, but also the outlook people had on life. Some examples here were Hard Bargain Branch, Lousy Creek, Worry, Noland, Big Trouble, Hell's Half Acre, and Devil's Tater Patch. Now onto the foodways. The diet here differed from, say, the areas where the Cavaliers were prevalent. The standard dish for supper in the mid-18th century was a wooden bowl of milk and mush, seasoned with a splash of bear oil. I have no idea what that's all about. An Anglican missionary to the backcountry complained incessantly of what they fed him. Clabber, butter, fat, mushy bacon, cornbread as for tea and coffee they know not. Neither beef nor mutton nor beer, cider or anything better than water, end quote. One noted that these people lived on what in England was given to hogs. Commonly, food was boiled and, oddly, it was believed that dirt was needed for a good meal. The more hair in the butter, the better. They had a saying, the more dirt, the less hurt. Lastly, you have power and liberty. In general, Southerners believed in personal government. It was your job to look after yourself. They believed in strong personal leadership and often lived in small communities, which were made up of members of the same clan. They believed in natural freedom and the natural law of ideas of, say, John Locke. They, for the most part, shunned authority. They did not believe in law and order being handed down from a central authority. Remember, they believed in personal government, so they saw no need for that central power. This would mean that, in the South, most, if not all, believed in the idea of minimal government and light taxes. They also felt that it was their responsibility to arm themselves to protect against tyranny, whether that was local or from some outside force. Now, before we go, there are some great books on these people, two of which are Grady McWhinney's and Forrest MacDonald's Cracker Culture, Celtic Ways in the Old South, published by the University of Alabama Press in the late 1980s. Another great work is one I've already mentioned, David Hackett Fisher's Albion Seed, There are others, but these are two of the best and would be where I would start if you want to read up on this some more. Okay, well, that's it for today. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did bringing it to you. Until next time, have a great day. Do you like the sound of the American History Podcast? My audio production is provided by the Mad Octopus. Check them out over at madoctopusmedia.com.